Alrighty, here we go. Didactic Mind, episode 20. Believe it or not, episode 20 in 2020. And today's episode is called The Ides of March, because it is, of course, March 15th when you're hearing this. And it portends to, or it refers to the famous portent given in Shakespeare's Julius Caesar, where the soothsayer, or the prophet, goes up to Julius Caesar himself and says to him, "Beware the Ides of March," which turns out to be a rather calamitous warning, because that is the date on which old JC was stabbed to death by all of his erstwhile allies and many of his enemies in the Senate. Very warm welcome, everybody, to all of my loyal readers from the blog, all of my loyal SoundCloud subscribers. If you have not already subscribed either to the blog or to this podcast, please make sure you do so. That way you will never miss another upload, you will never miss another blog post. And I think most of my loyal readers will certainly agree that my blog is one of the more interesting spots on the web. It doesn't get a whole lot of traffic relative to some of the bigger ones out there, but I do have a long-standing readership who have been around for, in some cases, like 5+ years. So clearly I'm doing something right, not to blow my own trumpet or anything, but clearly something about it holds a lot of appeal. So this past week has seen any number of apocalyptic, crazy, impossible to predict events. It really was the week from hell, not just for me personally, because there was a lot of craziness that happened in my personal life, which I don't really want to go into, but Lady Troubles is probably the best way to put it, of a kind that I've not seen before, and it wasn't pleasant. That is on top of global travel restrictions, global travel bans, really, coming into force all over the world. And this is, I wanted to talk about this because although I referred to Corona-chan in my last podcast, and I don't really want to go over the same details again, you know, I've talked about how the virus itself is certainly more dangerous than the flu overall. I mean, the mortality rates are anywhere between 10 and 100 times higher. But it is also much, much less dangerous than everyone thinks it is. I mean, it spreads very fast, but it's nowhere near as lethal as the last major coronavirus outbreak, which was not SARS in 2003, but actually MERS, Middle East Respiratory Syndrome, which was another coronavirus, and that had a fatality rate of 40%, thereabouts. SARS had a fatality rate, a mortality rate of about 9.6%. COVID-19, or SARS-CoV-2, as it is more commonly called, or not more commonly called, but scientifically referred to, is significantly less dangerous than that. I mean, if you look at the actual data, our beloved and dreaded Supreme Dark Lord, Vox Dei, peace be unto him, posted a rather informative graphic on his blog a few days ago, where it looked at the overall mortality rates between various age ranges for regular influenza, which is, I mean, it's not just, influenza isn't just one virus. Influenza is, like, the influenza virus has a very large number of substrains, which mutate very rapidly. So if you look at the mortality rate for all influenza strains as a whole, in the United States, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, will give you a pretty decent breakdown. And what becomes pretty clear is that anyone below the age of about 50 has virtually no chance of dying. I mean, it requires extreme complications from the flu to die of that stuff. The mortality rate for people over 65 is 0.83%. For people between 50 and 64 is 0.06%. Now, if you go and look at the mortality rates for COVID-19, the mortality rates for people between 50 and 59 is 1.3%. For people between 60 and 69, it's 3.6%. For people between 70 and for people over 80, it skyrockets. For people between 70 and 79, mortality rate is about 8%. And for people 80 plus, it's about 14.8%. So this is a dangerous disease. Make no mistake about it. Those of us, self-included, I'll stick my own hand up and say this because I have said words to this effect on the blog. For those of us who said that this isn't going to be too much worse than the average common cold, well, in terms of mortality rate, we were wrong. In terms of overall spread, we're right. This is nowhere near as infectious as a common cold or an influenza strain. I mean, even today, the total number of victims worldwide stands at about 150,000, and quite a large chunk of that actually is sitting in Europe, where the Europeans have really done a pretty spectacularly bad job of containing this outbreak. What we will find over the coming weeks and months is that there will be a lot of interesting information and analysis that comes out over who did what, when, and what worked and what didn't. We can rightly criticize the Chinese for taking way too long to respond to this outbreak, as they always do. I mean, all of these horrible diseases come out of the dirt world where there is opportunistic eating. And survival bushcraft, almost, if you will, or wet markets in existence. China is one of those countries, one of those regions. Africa is another. If you look at the way that diseases have spread over time, HIV and AIDS spread originally from monkeys and from possibly from chimpanzees, most likely from monkeys. The two aren't the same. Chimpanzees are part of the great apes family. They're different from monkeys, qualitatively speaking. But apparently the reason why HIV spread from monkeys and apes to humans is because these creatures were slaughtered for bushmeat. And then the disease spread from, you know, bush inhabitants, hunters, poachers, to the general population, and really spread very, very rapidly through the gay community, which is why originally it was called gay-related immune disease, or immunodeficiency disease, because that's what it was. It was a gay disease. It was a disease confined mostly to homosexual men. Why? Because homosexual men are highly promiscuous. And I don't care if gays are offended by that, by me saying that. That's what you guys are. You guys have lifestyles that are deeply degenerate and dangerous to yourselves and to people around you. And that's, you know, you've chosen that lifestyle. I sympathize with your plight, but I don't sympathize with your choices that you've made. I mean, this is not something you have no control over. It's just that this is how you've chosen to live, so be it. But with respect to SARS, for instance, SARS came out of China and was subjected to kind of the same problems in terms of quarantine initially, at least, that COVID-19 has been subjected to, which was essentially came down to massive blanketing and blackouts of all information that could have helped people stop the disease. By the time the Chinese got their act together, the disease was all over Southeast Asia and was spreading around the world. And while it was pretty infectious, it was nowhere near as bad as COVID-19 has proven to be. Much less fast-moving, much less infectious, much more lethal, which tends to be the pattern with diseases like this. What you typically find, not always, but typically find, is that diseases which are highly infectious or contagious are usually, and I stress, usually, less deadly. Why? Because diseases which are really deadly tend to burn themselves out very quickly. They tend to run out of victims to infect. Now, there are exceptions to this, okay? I am not making a blanket statement. I am not an immunologist. and I do not pretend to have expertise in the field, I can point to three or four different diseases which break this pattern. One of which, of course, is bubonic plague, the Black Death, which killed, estimates range up to about 60% of Europe's population in the 14th century. That's how bad it was. I mean, it got to the point where Cambridge University shut their doors for 2 years to try to ward off the plague. Now, back then, you know, 700 years ago, the understanding of how diseases spread was non-existent compared to what it is today. People still thought in terms of humors and vapors being the cause of infectious diseases. The idea, germ theory, wasn't anywhere near the scene yet. So this was a time when people thought it was possible to beat such viruses or such plagues, because bubonic plague is not caused by a virus. It is very much a qualitatively different disease. It is caused effectively by a bacterium, not a virus, and it's a particularly pestilential bacterium. It's really quite horrific what it does to people. So people thought you could treat this by kind of bleeding and bloodletting and using leeches. And it really spread very fast because of extremely poor sanitation habits, extremely poor hygiene. Now, this was at a time when cities were places where you went to die. Cities had a much higher mortality rate than the countryside, and cities were considered to be crowded, smelly, noisy sewage pits. They were just absolutely disgusting places to live. That is no longer the case in the West. So outbreaks like this, which were once common in the Western world, aren't so common anymore, precisely because the Western world has become advanced and clean, and the ideas that really proliferated during the Enlightenment, such as germ theory, antibiotics, the development of antibiotics in the 20th century, which, by the way, is not new. For those of you who think Alexander Fleming invented penicillin, he did, in the sense that he discovered it. Like, he discovered what penicillin is and how to grow it in an efficient sort of mass manufacturing way. But antibiotics were not a Western invention. I mean, back in the day, the Turks, believe it or not, the Ottoman Turks were the ones who developed a method of taking bread, sticking it under the saddles of their horses, letting it kind of ferment and get some yeast infections on it, more or less, fungal infections. And they used that fungal infection of the bread to pack the wounds of their janissaries and soldiers to ward off infection and death. So this method of disinfecting soldiers and of using antibiotics, specifically antibacterial treatments, is not new. It's been around for centuries. It's just that it took someone like Fleming to discover it and figure out how to manufacture it in an efficient way. So the ideas behind this stuff are not new, but the Western world is the first to really figure out how to take these ideas and make them part of our daily life and society, to the point where we don't even think about it anymore. I mean, all you have to do to contrast the First World with the Third World is to pay a visit to Moscow and then go to Calcutta or Karachi or any South Indian crap hole, really. That's all you have to do. Moscow is an advanced, beautiful, orderly, wonderful place to be. It's well-maintained, very clean. I mean, astonishingly clean. Like, if you're used to walking the streets of London and you just see leaves and junk and dirt everywhere and the sidewalks are disgusting and they're just not pleasant places to be, take a walk down one of Moscow's city sidewalks sometime in the spring or in the autumn before the snow sets in, because once the snow hits in sort of late October, early November, everything becomes this dirty, slushy nightmare. It's ugly, and Muscovites and Russians in general have developed a number of ways of dealing with the fact that life gets very dirty as a result of the snow, the snow, the ice, and the grit. So this way of maintaining a clean household and a clean environment is common to us in the West. It's common to Westerners, and Westerners have figured out how to make it work. If you live in a gated community in the dirt world, you don't have to worry about basic hygiene because it's taken care of for you. But if you look at the average dwelling in the dirt world, in places like China, India, Iran, and elsewhere, especially Africa, basic sanitation and hygiene is not really much of a concern. That's why these diseases keep popping up, and that's why they keep inflicting such horrendous casualties on primarily, unfortunately, dirt worlders. Now, the interesting thing about COVID-19 is that since it's jumped over to Europe and has really sparked a lot of mass infections there and a lot of mass panic, one thing that is becoming very evident is that some societies are more resilient than others. That's becoming very obvious. Some societies are much more capable of handling these extreme tail events than others. If you look at China, the Chinese have handled it in a very Chinese, top-down, bureaucratic, authoritarian fashion. They've basically locked down, or they had locked down at one point, about one-third of their population. So about 500 million people were under quarantine. They were told, do not come out of your homes, do not go to work, you will not be outside. If you go outside, you'll be arrested. And you have to apply for permission to go out and get basic groceries. Only one member of your family is allowed out at a time. Now, those restrictions have since been rolled back somewhat, and about 40%, last time I checked, of the residents of Wuhan at the epicenter of the outbreak were told you can go back to work. So the Chinese are looking at resuming normal output sometime in about mid-April. We'll see if that holds true, but so far at least, it looks like Asia is coming out of this relatively intact, although I would bet that the Chinese trust in their government has been severely shaken by now. Because when you have 80,000 people confirmed with infections, and you have God only knows how many millions of people in lockdown, and you have about 4,000, roughly speaking, deaths out of those 80,000 infected, then the people are going to start asking some very serious questions. Now, I want to just interject briefly at this point to mention that the mortality rates that we're seeing are almost certainly vastly overstated. Because one of the things about this disease, COVID-19, which is really interesting, is the fact that you can get it and you can be asymptomatic for pretty much the entire time you have it, especially if you're young and very healthy. A lot of the people who catch this disease, probably the majority of them, will have this virus in their systems, and they won't know it. They won't have a clue that they're actually infected, because they're not going to show any symptoms whatsoever. Or if they do show symptoms, it's going to be very mild and very easily confused with something like a common cold. So they're not going to get checked out. Which means that if you don't have the symptoms, then don't bother getting checked. It's like, don't worry about it. Right? Only start worrying when there's time, when there's a reason to worry, okay? So this is my advice to all of my listeners, all of my readers. Please don't panic about this. And this is going to be a theme throughout the rest of this podcast, this episode. I want to make it clear that panicking is not going to help. This is not the end of the world as we know it, so please don't act like it is. This is just another test that we have to get through. And it's going to be painful, it's going to be miserable, it's going to be very difficult for a while. For the next 2 weeks, it's going to be really hard on a lot of people. But please don't panic, all right? Coming back to what I said earlier and tying back to this theme of not panicking, it is clear that certain societies are going to come out of this much better off than others. Low-trust societies, low-cohesion societies, are going to come out of this really badly. And this is a theme that John Ringo touched on in his novel, The Last Centurion, which, I mean, I swear the guy had a crystal ball when he wrote this novel, because he predicted so many of the events that came to pass 10 years later. I don't know how he did it. I really don't have a clue how John Ringo did this. But he sat down and he just, like, brain vomited onto the pages of his word processor this huge, very complex 500-page novel of the times of the plague, effectively, where H5N1, bird flu, becomes human transmissible and highly infectious and goes around the world and kills off about 60%, anywhere between, well, depending on the location, anywhere between 30 and 80% of the world's population, depending on where it hit. And the point that he makes over and over again is that societies with very limited trust between people imploded in such a scenario. And societies where people trust their neighbors, they trust their friends, they trust their colleagues, maintain themselves very well. Now, if you look at most South and East Asian societies, those are highly homogeneous and low trust, believe it or not. The Chinese don't particularly trust each other. They really don't trust outsiders, and they don't particularly trust their own government. Nor should they. There's no good reason for them to trust any of these entities. Historically speaking, the Chinese government has been a source of misery and tension for the average Chinese person. And that trend has continued for their entire 5,000-year history, especially over the last 100 years or so. Because over the last 100 years, the Chinese have seen anywhere from basically the end of their monarchy in 1911 or thereabouts to dictatorship to something resembling democracy, which didn't last very long, of course, because it was China, to dictatorship again under Chiang Kai-shek, to communism. Well, first to Japanese occupation, and then to outright communism. And the outright communism was incredibly damaging to their culture, their economy, their national psyche, to pretty much their entire sense of who they were and are. Their government has not exactly covered itself in glory in the last 20-odd years of these outbreaks. And there have been a few of them, and they've been pretty bad. And the response from the Chinese government has always been the same. First, cover up until it gets too bad to cover up anymore, and then go in and overcompensate in the other direction and just implement, you know, military-style crackdowns. So that is not a recipe for long-term stability, in my opinion, of course. Turning to Europe, it's interesting what we're seeing right now. The entire European experiment was effectively one in open borders and non-homogeneous societies kind of coming together in a super union of supposedly like-minded countries. Now, leave aside the sheer ridiculousness of the entire premise, which is to say that the Europeans could manage the economy of Greece just as well as they could manage the economy of Finland, and that the two countries, which are radically different in terms of culture, weather, temperament, economic prosperity, outlook, well-being, I mean, you name it, you know, these countries have radically different approaches to just about every aspect of life. The idea behind the European Union was that a Greek was the same as a Finn, was the same as a German, was the same as a Swede, was the same as a Pole, was the same as a Spaniard, and so on and so forth, and etc., etc., ad infinitum. That's simply not true. These countries all have different mentalities, different mindsets, different levels of social trust, and different levels of personal trust. So the idea that you would have open borders between all of them, and that would be okay, that would stand up to any crisis, that would allow for a European family, has proven to be disastrous and incredibly stupid. Now, one thing that nobody wants to talk about is the fact that Italy, which is one of the kind of epicenters of the COVID-19 outbreak and is by far the worst hit area of Europe so far, is that there was a large contingent, quite a large contingent, of Chinese migrant workers living and working in Italy for Italian firms, which were encouraged by the globalist ambitions of the European superstate to bring in workers from overseas and work in Italy, and there would be direct flights from Italy, you know, whichever city it was in Italy, back to Wuhan. I think it was Milan, actually. Back to Wuhan, and it, not exactly coincidentally, Milan turns out to be one of the worst hit cities in all of Italy with COVID-19. I wonder why. But to make matters worse, because the Europeans don't have closed borders between their countries, the number of cases skyrocketed very quickly because there was complete freedom of movement between all the borders. That has come to a crashing halt this week. If you look at countries around Europe, pretty much like 15 out of the top 20 infection zones within the world, and the US is now unfortunately within the top 20, but 15 out of the top 20 infection areas in the world are all in Europe. And if you look at all the Scandi countries, if you look at the UK, you look at Italy, of course, Spain, France, Germany, the Netherlands, and so on, Belgium, if you look at all of them in total, you know, every one of those countries has over 500 cases easily. Italy, France, Germany, Spain, they all have cases numbering in the thousands. And unfortunately, in countries where there is a significant number of old people, like Italy, the mortality rates are going to be pretty dire. I'm sorry to say that, but that's the truth. It's going to be very, very grim for a lot of old people living in Italy right now. And God bless them. I wish them the best. But it's going to be very hard for a lot of families in Italy over the next couple of weeks. This coming Easter is going to be a very difficult one for them. And I am truly sorry to say that. And I genuinely, truly, I mean, I pray for these people. I wish them the best. I am truly sorry that this has happened to them. They didn't deserve this. But unfortunately, this is the result, the direct result of some of the stupidest policies that you can imagine. Because if you look at Western Europe, that's where, Western Europe and the Scandinavian countries, I should say, that's where this disease has hit the hardest. If you look at Central and Eastern Europe, all of a sudden the infection rates plummet. Why is that? I mean, why is it that the Czech Republic, which closed its borders on Thursday and started the process of closing its borders, declared a state of emergency on March 12th, basically said that anybody coming into the country from overseas would be banned from specific places, so like China, Italy, South Korea, Spain, and a few others, all the epicenters of the virus, those travelers coming into the Czech Republic would be banned from entering. They would not be allowed. And then, you know, so flights coming in from those countries would not be allowed anymore. And then they declared a state of emergency, and then they said, as of March 16th, all foreign travelers, all of them coming into the Czech Republic, will no longer be allowed to get in. It's like, whoa, okay. And Czech citizens will not be allowed to get out. And that's the whole of the country. It's not just Prague, which is where the actual virus hit. It's the whole of the Czech Republic is now under quarantine. So all of their citizens are now under lockdown. If you look at Poland, they've done kind of the same thing. They've basically shut their borders. If you look at Hungary, they've shut their borders. Now, what is the difference between the cultures of these places that Poland, Hungary, Czech Republic, Slovakia, Czechia, as I call them, Czech Republic, Slovakia, Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia, and so on and so forth, etc., have all seen relatively low infection rates? What is it about them? I mean, if I look at the Johns Hopkins map for COVID-19 outbreaks, this information is a bit dated as of this recording. I mean, the numbers are undoubtedly going to go up. But if you look at Czechia, as of right now, as of the moment that I'm talking to you, there are 141 confirmed cases. Again, this information is a day or two old. It's going to go up. Okay, so that number is not confirmed. By the time you listen to this, I'll stick a link in the description box for the podcast so that you can check the numbers yourself. But it's going to be a lot higher than that in the next day or two. If you look at Poland, 68 cases, 2 deaths. All right. Slovakia, 32 cases. Hungary, 19 cases, 1 recovered, 18 active. Serbia, 35 cases. Romania, 89 cases. Bulgaria, 23 cases, 1 death. North Macedonia, 14 cases. Albania, 33 cases. Looking even further east, Moldova, 6 cases. Ukraine, 3 cases, 1 death, 2 active. Belarus, 27 cases, 3 recovered, so 24 active. Lithuania, 6 cases. Latvia, 17 cases, 1 recovered. Estonia, 79 cases. Now, just north of Estonia is, of course, Finland. Finland, 155 cases. West of Finland, Sweden, 814 cases, 1 death, 1 recovered. West of Sweden, Norway, 996 cases, 1 death, 1 recovered. South of Norway, Denmark, 801 cases, 1 recovered. Netherlands, 804 cases, active, 10 deaths, 794 active. Germany, 3,675 confirmed cases, 46 recovered. Switzerland, weirdly enough, 1,139 cases, 11 deaths, and 4 recovered. France, 3,661 cases, 79 deaths, 12 recovered. Italy, that's really a disaster. 17,660 cases, 1,266 deaths, 1,439 recovered, so that leaves us with about 15,000 active cases. And then you go to Spain, 5,232 cases, of which there have been 133 deaths, 193 recovered, so we're still looking at about 4,900 active cases. So, just looking at all of that, you can see that there is a vast disparity between the way that Western Europe has been hit and the way that Central and Eastern Europe has been hit. If you look at Russia, there are 45 confirmed cases in all of Russia. This is the biggest country in the world. Moscow is a city of about 16 million people. All of the cases that we know of, as far as I'm aware, are in Moscow. There was a situation in Moscow itself where Moscow State University students, about 70 of them, I think, had to be quarantined because one of them had come back from Italy and tested positive for coronavirus and was immediately whisked away and put into quarantine. So the Russians closed their borders with China back in January. Now, that is a pretty good insight and clue into why the Eastern Europeans have done a much better job of dealing with COVID-19 than pretty much anybody else, okay? The Russians closed their borders really fast to China, and since then they've taken even more radical steps by basically shutting down a lot of international air traffic. So now, you know, a lot of flights going in and out of Europe have been shut down. International travel has been greatly curtailed. But from what I'm seeing and hearing, Moscow life carries on pretty much as normal. Okay, there's no panic in Moscow. Nobody's particularly worried. Nobody's freaking out. Nobody's really in any hurry to stock up on stuff. There's no sense that this is a particularly dire situation, even though the Putin government and his ally in Moscow, the mayor of Moscow, Sergei Sobyanin, have taken pretty radical steps to deal with it. There's no real sense that this is in any way particularly dangerous or urgent. They're worried about it, but they're not freaking out. Meanwhile, over in Europe, they're absolutely freaking out. That the Russian response and the response of a lot of the Eastern and Central European countries tells you which societies are going to survive and come out of this really much stronger than before. If you look at Eastern Europe, and if you look at Central Europe, what you find is high-trust, homogeneous societies. If you look at Western Europe, you find relatively low-trust, increasingly relatively low-trust, I should say, heterogeneous societies. If you look at France, Germany, the Scandi countries, if you look at the UK, which, by the way, has been isolated to a significant extent because in the UK they did have Brexit relatively recently, which was great for them, wonderful. And that means that they were able to take control of their own borders again. So they were able to formulate their own independent response from the Europeans, and while the situation there is bad, it's still nowhere near as bad as somewhere like Italy or France, okay? The British press is giving the Prime Minister Boris Johnson absolute hell for his handling of the crisis, but the reality is he's actually doing a pretty decent job. He's not really panicking. There isn't really much reason to panic. I mean, the UK has about 800 cases right now and 8 deaths. I think there was a small child that died quite recently, which is really sad. But there's a newborn baby in London that became the youngest coronavirus victim ever. And we've actually hit, according to the Daily Mail as of right now, 11 deaths in the UK and about 800 cases. So what are we looking at in terms of societies? Well, the societies which have let in large numbers of migrants and which have not closed their borders quickly enough and which have abided by the European principle of total freedom of movement are the ones that are worst hit. There's no way to escape that conclusion. The countries which have exercised extreme caution about who they let in and were quick to act in shutting their borders and making sure that foreigners were screened and were not were isolated and were not able to just do whatever they wanted. Countries like Hungary, Poland, Czech Republic, and a few others, they have been much more protected. The countries where they have embraced the kind of neoliberal globalist world order in Denmark, Sweden, Norway, Finland, those countries have been absolutely devastated by this outbreak, and they're going to be devastated by it for some time to come, unfortunately. So this is what we're looking at. I mean, we're looking at a pretty severe outbreak. Pretty severe outbreak across all of Europe, but mostly confined to Western Europe. Central and Eastern Europe are not going to be too badly off, unless they do something really stupid, which it looks like they're not going to do. Now, turning to America, what's going to happen there? Well, President Trump has gotten a lot of flack from the media, who absolutely hate his guts about his handling of the outbreak. But that's not fair to him, because President Trump took steps back in January to shut down all travel from China. And now he's taken steps to shut down all travel from Europe, mainland Europe. And next, apparently, he's going to take steps to shut down all travel from the United Kingdom. Now, the USA is a huge country. It's enormous. There are 330 million people there. And right now, if you look at the US, according to this map, in the USA, there are, right now, 2,174 cases. Now, again, this is from the Johns Hopkins database, so this information is dated. The number is much higher than this in reality. And we're looking at, 50-odd deaths throughout the entire U.S. Now, let's be clear. This could have been 10 times worse, and it should have been 10 times worse, but it wasn't. Why is that? Because the USA took proactive steps to shut down the borders and to make sure that anyone coming in was from a non-outbreak center, was not from an outbreak center, you know what I mean? That much is becoming very obvious and very clear, that the president was absolutely right to shut down flights coming out of China and to take immediate action, which at the time people thought he was panicking. Now people are like, wait, he's not panicking fast enough. Well, guys, make up your mind. I mean, if the Hollywood elite and the media oligarchs want to say that he's overreacting, then they need to present evidence that this outbreak isn't as bad as we think it is. But actually, it's worse than we think it is. And if they're saying he's not reacting fast enough, well, they need to find other countries, other examples where the reaction has been faster. The only country that comes to mind is Singapore, and maybe South Korea. The Singaporeans shut down their borders really fast, and they're going to take an absolute ass-kicking in terms of their economy very soon. They're going to be in really, really bad trouble. because they are heavily trade dependent. I mean, the way to look at Singapore is as a trade leveraged nation. The amount of trade that comes through that country is a multiple of its own GDP. So when trade gets affected by coronavirus, just like it was with SARS in 2003, the local economy shuts down and people go through incredible pain and suffering for about 3 months before things bounce back. So they're going to come out of this just fine. I think the USA is going to come out of it pretty well too. Why? Because you have a leader in charge who actually knows what he's doing, understands how to respond to a crisis because he's been through a number of such similar personal crises before, you know, with his business. He understands how to get in front of the problem, how to let the experts do the talking, more or less, with some exceptions. I mean, I don't like the way that he's kind of talked over some of the lead scientists, and that he is plainly, I mean, he was plainly false, making false statements when he said that anyone who needs a test can get tested. That has proven to be absolutely untrue. And he was plainly talking out his ass when he said that goods and services from Europe would be placed under quarantine. He then turned around and said, no, they wouldn't. So there are mixed messages coming out of the Trump administration to some degree. But overall, the general tone has been very good. He's made it very clear that Mike Pence, who looks like, you know, Race Bannon from the Johnny Quest series, and is therefore a very reassuring, masculine, you know, alpha male type presence in such a situation, has been on top of things. And it's great to see that. You know, he's put his point man in charge. He said, you guys run with this. You guys do whatever is necessary. You're going to have my full backing. He's held press conferences. He's made it very clear that the economy is going to be supported no matter what. And he's made it, he's given the right advice. Wash your hands. Limit public exposure. If you feel sick, stay at home. Above all, do not panic. This is great advice. This is exactly what people should be doing. And this is the same advice that I've given to my readers and my listeners. Don't panic, okay? Countries where social trust is high, which have cut off travel from outside, and which have enacted some level of social distance, are going to come out of this doing just fine. So looking at, you know, coming back to this theme of the Ides of March, doom, gloom, catastrophe, calamity, apocalypse, etc., I want to take a look at the way that markets have been responding, and devote the last third or so of this podcast to what we can look forward to over the next 3 to 6 months. Okay, I know markets have been a very wild ride of late. It's been crazy. I mean, the Dow Jones has been slinging up and down. It's been bonkers. The thing to remember about equity prices is don't worry about them. Unless you're nearing retirement, this turmoil, this instability is not going to affect you. And if you are nearing retirement, then you really, if you haven't done this already, you need to seriously consider rebalancing your portfolio. Once you get close to retirement, your focus should shift away. You know, by the time you're in the 55 to 65 zone, your focus should be shifting away from stocks as the primary component of your portfolio, more towards bonds, because you're not really in the wealth generation stage anymore. You're in the wealth preservation stage. Those of you who have 70%+ exposure in your portfolios to stocks at the age of 60, really need to rebalance. You need to rebalance back to about 50% bonds, 50% stocks, or better yet, 50% bonds, 30% stocks, 20% cash. Okay? This isn't me talking at my ass. This is not me telling you as an investment advisor what to do. I am not an investment advisor. If you want good advice, go to an investment advisor you actually trust. I don't trust most of them. That's just me, because I think most of them are overpaid hacks. Everything you need to learn about investing, you can learn on your own quite easily. But if you want an investment advisor's advice, go get it. Don't listen to me. Don't take my word for it. Go do your own homework. Go get a second opinion. Okay? But this isn't me telling you off the top of my head what to do. This is the advice of perhaps the greatest investor of all time, Benjamin Graham, who taught definitely the greatest investor of all time, Warren Buffett, back in Columbia University, how to pick stocks and how to value them and how to go about amassing a portfolio of stocks. Ben Graham wrote a book called The Intelligent Investor, which, as far as I'm concerned, is required reading for anybody who wants to get into investing. That book is well over 50 years old. but it is still the best advice that you can get about how to measure and balance a portfolio, how to figure out what stocks are good and what stocks are bad. And in that book, he makes it very clear that if you are in, you know, the sort of beginning phase of your career, if you're in the early 20s to late 30s of your life, most of your portfolio should be in stocks. So about 70 to 90%, you know, depending on how times are going. In times of exuberance, in times of extreme irrational exuberance, dial that down, you know, depending on where you are in the market and depending on what your age is. So dial it down back to a more conservative level. So if you're young and you have like 90% of your savings invested in the stock market and you see that the market keeps going up and up and up and it doesn't make any sense why, dial it back down. Dial it down to 60, 70%, 70 at the maximum, and start investing more in bonds. In times of extreme pessimism and negativity, when the markets are crashing, ramp it back up. Because the best time to sell is when everyone else is buying, and the best time to buy is when everyone else is selling. As a general rule, there are plenty of exceptions to that. Ben Graham himself, I think, may have coined the phrase, don't try to catch a falling knife. And he was right. So don't give in to panic, all right? When you see the markets going topsy-turvy like this, don't panic. Take a deep breath. Step back and ask yourself what you're doing in your portfolios, with your savings, to make sure that you're not too exposed, all right? Take some time to reevaluate where your holdings are, what's going on with all of your various stocks. If you're invested in individual stocks, take some time to worry about what those stocks are doing, you know, whether the underlying business is sound. If it's sound, don't worry about it. You know, just stay invested. Don't worry that the stock price is crashing. The business itself is going to be fine. And I'll give you an example of this. Johnson & Johnson in the 1997 financial crisis in Asia, they had to let go thousands of workers in Asia. But the reason they had to let them go was not because of any monkeying around with their balance sheets or any stupid FX hedges, hedging schemes that they'd done. It wasn't because they'd done anything dumb with the underlying business. The underlying business was extremely strong. It was generating plenty of cash flow. There's plenty of revenue coming in. There was no debt to worry about, you know, no debt to speak of. Capital expenditures were under control. The business was growing on a sustainable, sound footing across all of Asia. The problem was that Asian demand had cratered because, of course, all of the Asian economies were in ruins. They were just like smoking craters in the ground. So when Johnson & Johnson let go of all those people, they sat there and, you know, all the company managers, and I know this from because I have personal links to that company, all of the managers sat there and had some business roundtables, and they sat there and went through their balance sheets and their profit statements, their income statements, and especially their cash flow statements, and they said, well, you know what, on a cash flow basis, we're fine. The business itself is okay. We're just going to have to take some pain, cut some costs, cut a lot of costs, but we're not going to need to close down too many of our factories. We're not going to need to lay off too many of our people. Yes, there's going to be a lot of pain. There's going to be a lot of layoffs, but it's not going to be catastrophic. It's not going to be cataclysmic. That is the model that I want you to think about, because when the Asian economies bounce back, Johnson & Johnson's growth bounced back as well. And they've been growing, you know, some of their businesses in the region have been growing in double digits ever since. That is the way to look at this, the economic disruption from COVID-19. A lot of businesses are going to feel tremendous pain, especially the travel industry, which is a very exposed business to these sorts of plagues and contagions. In the aftermath of SARS in 2003, the travel industry took an absolute beating, and the airlines industry was just hemorrhaged billions, and thousands, tens of thousands of employees were laid off. This is going to be much worse. I mean, we're talking potentially hundreds of thousands of layoffs all around the world. I know what that's like. I've been laid off 3 times in my life. Every single job I've ever held has failed to come through in any meaningful way. Okay, every single one. I know what it's like to see all of your hopes and dreams destroyed in an instant. So I am speaking from a position of sympathy and empathy for the people who are going to go through this. it's going to be absolutely miserable. For those of you in the financial sector, for those people who work for banking, you don't have any sympathy from me, unless I know you personally. I have no sympathy for you. You're going to get what's coming, and I'm very happy about that. But those of you in the travel industry, those in the manufacturing industry, those in the retail industry, you're going to see a lot of pain in the near future. But please, don't panic, okay? I know things are going to get very rough for the next couple of weeks and a couple of months. My advice to you is, number one, stay calm. Most importantly, when this is happening to you, stay calm. Number two, if you're in an industry which is hit hard by this epidemic, make sure that you have at least 3 months of savings in cash in the bank. In cash, not credit card lines, not debt instruments, not equities that you can sell. Cold, hard cash in the bank, sitting there gathering interest, okay, that you can withdraw. If you need to withdraw about a month's worth of hard cash, hard currency, and keep it under your bed, do that, all right? Make sure that you have plenty of soap, food, and water sitting in your house. Make it about a month's supply, and you should be okay. If you're in one of these really hard-hit countries, such as in Western Europe or in the United States, if you're in, for instance, Czech Republic, where there are a lot of travel bans, then, you know, the Czech Republic is not going to be too bad, because from what I'm reading, restaurants are going to be forced to close from 8 p.m. onwards, but shopping and like refreshment, serving of refreshments in shopping centers is banned. But you can still go to the grocery store, you can still take public transport, you can still go to work if you have to. They've not gotten to that level of extreme closure yet. But make sure you have a decent amount of cash in the bank, decent amount of cash available to you personally. Make sure that your home is reasonably well stocked for with about a month's worth of food. If you're in the USA and you're in a state which doesn't have idiotic gun control laws, then make sure that you have plenty of guns and plenty of ammo. Being long guns and ammo is never a bad policy. If you talking to stock investors, if you want a pretty much no-fail investing strategy, invest in gold, guns, and ammo. I'm serious. Like these are the three areas of life where, or three areas, three asset classes, which they're never going to go out of fashion. And as the world gets darker and darker and more crazy, they're going to come more and more into fashion. Okay, being long guns and ammo is always a good thing. All right. If you do get this virus, God forbid, again, please stay calm. Don't panic. Make sure you get tested. If you feel ill, stay at home. Limit your exposure to other people. Don't shake hands with people. I have readers who are going to listen to this next bit and absolutely rage from it, but I'm going to say it anyway. The Indian custom of doing namaste, which is basically, you know, you put your hands together and kind of bow to somebody, is probably a lot safer than shaking hands. I told one of my readers this, and he basically said, yeah, well, why don't you summon, nice going, summon a demon while you're at it. And I said to him, well, potentially killer disease versus summoning a demon, tough choice. Or better yet, don't greet anyone at all. Just give people a simple head nod. I mean, that works great. But again, don't panic. Be calm. It's going to be okay. As long as you are reasonably well prepared, as long as you don't take stupid risks, like that idiot in the NBA who went around touching a bunch of microphones just to show that there was nothing to worry about, and then contracted COVID-19, coronavirus. If you're that stupid, then you don't deserve to live, quite frankly. But if you take some sensible precautions, you wash your hands, you're careful, you're calm, you don't do anything particularly idiotic or dangerous, you'll be fine, okay? Make sure that you and your families have what you need for the next couple of months. Make sure that if you can work from home, you work from home. Make sure that you limit your exposure to outside sources. If you can exercise at home, great. I personally hate doing that because I hate body workouts, body weight workouts. I am a gym bunny all the way. But just be careful. That's my advice to you. Just be careful. That's all. Don't worry too much about what the markets are doing. Don't worry too much about where things are going to go in the future. We'll find out soon enough. Maintain trust in yourself and your neighbors if you live in a high-trust society. If you don't, my sympathies, but, you know, that's your culture. You chose to live like that. If you're in the U.S., you generally live in a high-trust society, especially if you live in the countryside, so you're probably going to be okay. The reality is that social distance in suburban and especially rural USA is enormous, much larger than in anywhere in Europe. The Russians have a much lower level of social distance than you guys do, and the Russians are famous for being pretty standoffish and pretty cold towards outsiders. They're actually not. I have found Russians to be genuinely kind and caring and welcoming people. They can be a bit nuts, but that's not their fault. Their characters are kind of like that. They're just a challenging people sometimes. But overall, if you exercise some sensible precautions, if you're careful with your daily life and daily work, you're going to come out of this okay. Move whatever finances you can into cash wherever you're able to. Stay calm. Don't panic. Be vigilant and alert. Take some simple, sane, straightforward precautions, but don't be overly concerned. This is not the end of the world. This is not a world-ending plague, and there is every reason to believe that we will come out of this in the next month or two, reasonably intact, and whatever economic pain you're going to feel right now is going to be erased very quickly, because the bounce back from these sorts of events, if we look throughout history, is extremely quick. If you look at SARS, 2003 was an absolutely horrendous year for Singapore's economy. I know, I was there. I saw it happen. In 2004, in 2003, for instance, their economy contracted by a considerable amount. Let me go look it up. Singapore recession 2003, because of SARS. In 2003, I believe they, here we go. If you look at the Monetary Authority of Singapore's bulletins, their economy in 2003 actually plodded along by about 1.1% in the first quarter, and then nosedived in the second quarter by like minus 5% almost. And then in the third quarter, it bumped up again. And by the fourth quarter, it was already growing again at plus 5%. And in Q1 2004, the growth was straight up into sort of 7% area. And that's what happened to Singapore in 2004. The economy contracted by about 3%, thereabouts, something like that, in 2003. In 2004, it grew by 7.1%, which is a growth rate that Singapore has been hard pressed to maintain since then. It's achieved it in some years, but most of the time it's because it's a developed economy, it hasn't been able to boost growth that much. But this is what you're going to see in the coming weeks and months, a similar situation, a really massive bounce back. So don't worry about it too much. The economy will come back. Just give it some time. Make sure that you're prepared. Make sure that you have cash on hand. Make sure that you have food and water on hand. Make sure that you are well stocked and supplied, okay? And most of all, don't panic. This isn't the end of the world. This is merely the Ides of March. This has been Didactic Mind, episode 20. Many thanks, as always, to all of you for your loyalty and for your patronage. And leave a comment here on the podcast or at the blog, and I will see you on the next one.